This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Lou Olkowski, host of Love Me, a podcast about the messiness of human connection. We've got a brand new season coming your way this summer that will punch you right in the heart. A secret diary takes over a young woman's identity, and a toothless chihuahua saves her owner's life. Subscribe at cbc.ca/loveme or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas. Everywhere, it seems, walls are going up and borders are being tightened. And inside those borders, there are angry debates and violent protests over who belongs within them and who doesn't.
People are rightly angry, and so how do we deal with that reality? At the same time, imagine a future in which we can belong to this country equally. And that question has not been answered.
With this episode, we begin a five-part international series we produced in partnership with the Laurier Institution. The series is called Us and Them: Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference.
I feel like being politically aware gives you a measure of what you're going to have to do. But that's it, right? This is the thing. This is the gist of life. This is it. That's why we're here.
Us and Them showcases five public talks, all in countries which have complex and troubled histories of dealing with the other. Canada, Germany, Israel, India, and South Africa, where I met our first speaker.
I'm not sure. I don't know, are you rolling or how you
feel?
Yeah, okay.
You
there's a saw happening in the background.
I think this is their wedding.
That laughter belongs to journalist and activist Tsisonki Msimang, and the sighing noise belongs to Johannesburg.
Something is always up in South Africa, and in Joburg in particular. I love the city a lot. I think it's a fantastic city. It's gritty, and it is both falling down and falling apart, and also moving up and being, you know, rebuilt. Sometimes in crazy, overly westernized ways, and then other times, like where we are now, in really thoughtful and beautiful ways.
Where we were was at a national landmark in Johannesburg, Constitution Hill, or Con Hill, as it's known locally.
Okay, where's we were supposed to go that way. Oh, this is, I forgot about this room. Oh my goodness.
You can see a video of us touring Constitution Hill on our website at cbc.ca/ideas.
So these are posters that you...
Yeah, so these are posters of all that. And in almost every single neighborhood had its own action committee, you know? So it would be action...
What struck me was how smoothly Tsisonki can code switch from thoughtful observations to penetrating social analysis to mischievous humor, all in a flash. And whatever mode she was in, I learned something new from her.
South Africans mobilized against apartheid was very local. What you had to do was break your resistance movement into lots of small pieces so that they were constantly not sure who they were fighting against and who, you know, who was a real revolutionary and who wasn't.
Constitution Hill gets its name because it's home to South Africa's Constitutional Court, the highest court in the land.
So this is the court. You see the beautiful...
Yes.
Beautiful carvings, and it has all the rights. The right to cultural, religious, and linguistic community life. These are some of the names of our justices.
I'd never seen a court like this one. It was impressive and stately, with a series of monumental steps made from old prison wall bricks. But it was also down to earth and accessible, even inviting.
The court was designed so that it would be accessible to South Africans. They chose to put it in Johannesburg, not Pretoria. Pretoria is the capital city, and yet our constitutional court is in Joburg. So people always say, why? Why did they do that? They've done it so that as you walk past, if you cut through, you see buses. This is, you know, this is, the court is part of the city. And what they wanted was the constitution to be part of the city, part of people's lives. So if you walk here, when you're inside, you can actually see the justices deliberating. Here, the justices can see people walking their feet. They can see as we walk and do our business. So it's a lovely concept.
It's not elevated above the people.
It's not above the people. In fact, the court, it's like a tradition, and it's set in a circle like a traditional kraal. The African space for deliberating and making community decisions was a circle. So they thought everything through really beautifully. The justices will go inside and you'll see they sit on cow hide chairs. The Nguni cows are a beautiful sort of treasure of this region, of this part of the world, you know, with the horns and the beautiful hides. So that's what the justices sit on. Can we go inside the court? Can we go inside the court?
Yes.
Thanks.
It's amazing we can move around as freely.
Yeah.
Like this is fabulous.
So this is where the big cases are heard.
Wow.
So, I mean, this is what I love about South Africa as an idea. I'm sitting, my bum is where my heroes' bums have been, to put it crudely.
But you can put it crudely.
But you can, and you can do it, right? And you can actually, like, do it. And no one is like, you know the officiousness of so many of our institutions. There's none of that. It's like, well, this is a free space. And this part, creating that kind of culture, is definitely what all of the justices have done. They have created a culture where the court is for the people. No one is asking any questions. The casualness with which I can put my head over my shoulder and say, hey, can we go inside?
Amazing.
You can take your time, as long as you don't see
the Sure. Thank you. We'll just edit that footage.
Just as Constitution Hill is saturated with political and historical symbolism, so is the city of Johannesburg itself.
We went to the Johannesburg Library.
Yes.
In front of the library, there's a beautiful statue of a woman, and it's recognizing the importance of women.
That's right.
In the end. In one hand is a Molotov cocktail.
That's so South African. I mean, it was such a huge... Because people had no other means, the righteousness around violence that you see in lots of, you know, parts of the global north, we just don't have that. People needed to pick up stones. They needed to do a lot of things that we wouldn't do in a peacetime, you know, situation, because we were dealing with an army that had guns, that had, you know, they had grenades, they had tear gas. So the disproportionate use of violence against people who were carrying, you know, a homemade Molotov cocktail, in some ways that statue and that symbol and that ability to acknowledge it and honor it is an ability to honor using what you've got. And, you know, South African women did lots of things that would be considered traditionally male. It's a testament to how many women were politically active, to how many women left children, didn't have children, lost children, and played hugely important roles in mobilizing politically in ways that all the stories that you hear everywhere else around the world about African women don't include women with a Molotov cocktail, don't include, you know, women in detention, you know, all of those things. So one of the great things about post-apartheid South Africa has been a real acknowledgement of that. It hasn't happened easily.
Nothing is easy, I think.
Yeah.
Constitution Hill is also home to a former prison complex, where Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela were once incarcerated. It also has what used to be a women's jail.
Sisonke and I met yesterday, literally here, literally in the women's jail. After that, we did a walk around Con Hill.
It was here that Sisonke gave her talk.
Well, many of you actually know Sisonke better than I do. It would be ridiculous of me to pretend that I could introduce her in any more effective way since we did just meet.
Although the concrete and metal bars made it a bit echoey, but it was the perfect venue, given what we'd just been talking about, the role played by women in the struggle against apartheid.
I can tell you, she is vibrant, she is intelligent, she is excited, she is committed. Please welcome Sisonke.
She called her talk, Eyes in the Back of Our Heads, Moving Forward While Looking Back.
I want to begin first by acknowledging the Khoikhoi and San people who are the original custodians of this land that we now call South Africa. As we stand here in a place that used to be one of incarceration and we remember the contributions of great South Africans who fought for the ideas we are going to discuss tonight, and whose bodies and spirits pass through this place, I want to pay my respects to the Khoi and to the San elders, both past and present. This is a standard way that people have of introducing any talk that happens in Australia, where I now live, which is a topic for another lecture. But I thought it would be appropriate to begin this way because so much of what we're talking about is the stories that often don't get talked about enough in our society. So I was asked to talk about diversity and difference at a time when around the world, the very idea that people ought to be able to live side by side and in peace, bound by respect for their civil, cultural, and political differences, is dying a not very slow death. A lager mentality has set in, and some days it seems that we are living in apocalyptic times. In Europe and America, there are these raging debates going on about building walls, arresting people on the street, deportations. Here, of course, in South Africa, as we get appalled when we hear about the news that is happening in the Western world, and it's nice to be able to be appalled by the behavior of Westerners, isn't it? Here in South Africa, of course, this kind of conduct is standard fare. Immigrants are routinely stopped and searched, and neighborhoods where people from African countries other than South Africa live are patrolled and monitored by the cops for both bribes and for deportations. This has been happening for years. A few lefty activists, you know, protest, but generally, as South Africans, we maintain a pretty shameful silence until the next flare-up of violence. Our immigration system itself is designed so that pretty much just rich people get in, right? It's manipulated so that the industrious, the hopeful, those who come with their songs and their languages and their textiles and their foods and their Africanity are treated with suspicion, often denied entry, turned back. So while we bemoan Brexit and the small-mindedness of Britons who have now cut off their noses to spite their faces by leaving Europe, in South Africa, across party lines, we seem to have a number of attitudes that suggest that you can shut down borders, that you can spur on economic growth by looking inwards rather than outwards. Most recently in February, there was an anti-immigrant march that was actually agreed to. It got a permit. I guess people have freedom of expression. And we've had a mayor of this very city, who says, illegal immigrants are, quote, holding our country to ransom, and I'm going to be the last South African to allow it. Now, while the resentments of poor South Africans who are locked into an apartheid economy still are crucial to engage with, so this issue of dismissing the sentiment that that's underneath xenophobia, I think, is important not to do that, right? So I think that the resentment of poor South Africans, of people who are locked into an apartheid economy, are crucial to engage with. But the problem of xenophobia and the ways in which it's particularly directed at African immigrants is a function not so much of economic pressure and stress as it is of political failure. So that's the failure I want to talk about a little bit today. Because how could we not talk about political failure on this particular day as we celebrate certain birthdays? So South Africa's xenophobia problem, I think, represents this country's inability to face up to and address complex social problems with a kind of humane practicality. So we are a society that is in denial about its diversity. And yet the reality is that in 1996, when we had that first census, there were 950,000. Foreign-born. Can't help it. Foreign-born people who were living in South Africa. 6 years later, this figure had grown to about 1 million people who are foreign-born. And then a decade later, Census 2011 told us that there were about 2.1 million people in South Africa who were foreign-born, right? So pretty significant number of people who are living in South Africa who are called foreign-born. And this doesn't take into account children of those people, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, we're talking about a fairly significant number of people. UNHCR considers the real figure of people living in South Africa who were born outside of South Africa. And here we're largely talking about Africans, so let's stop the coding, right? We're talking about 3.1 million people. So it's a lot of people. In the last few years, again, if we shoot back to Europe, we've seen people drowning at sea, attempting to cross the Mediterranean, and the responses of many European countries has been chilling. So everywhere in the world, we see the weak and the vulnerable seeking shelter because of political conditions that are not of their own making, being assaulted by the strong and by the protected. In South Africa, of course, migrants come for all the same reasons that they go to Europe. And in fact, there's increasing pressure. Climate change, conflict is growing, people are fleeing, etc. And so this country has made it clear that we don't even want those people. It's not just that we don't want migrants, we also don't want refugees. People in grave danger. People for whom fleeing is a matter of life or death. But they come still, of course, because as Warsha and Shire has told us, no one leaves home unless home is the mouth of a shark. So in the aftermath of the election of Trump and the triumph of Brexit, it seems that some Europeans and Americans are beginning to understand that populism and resistance to multiculturalism and immigration may not be the most sustainable options. Americans are in the throes of a robust resistance campaign against Trump, and that's been a remarkable thing to watch happen. The Google search analytics the day after Brexit showed us that a lot of people woke up with voter hangover, something I think South Africans can relate to. Similarly, looking at the Dutch electoral outcome, we see that they actually pushed back, right? So the progressive side of politics in Europe is starting to kind of organize itself. But essentially, I think the road to hell that Western countries are marching towards may have some detours. What all of this points to for us is the fact that we are living through a moment in which everywhere in the world, people are looking for hope, for models of places where diversity and multiculturalism work, for societies in which populism and nationalism are actively being resisted, where polarization has been defeated and a sense of nationhood based on shared values is taking root instead. Once upon a time, South Africa would have been the place people looked towards to prove that all of this stuff can work. It's clear that those days are well and truly over. I think that people can come and tour and look at South Africa for what we've done in the past. But for our present moment, we are no longer, I think, as exemplary as we once were. So that's what I want to talk about. Why is it that a place that held so much possibility for change, a place with all the inbuilt mechanisms for political and social dynamism, has fallen into such disarray? There has been much focus in recent years on the fact that the truth and reconciliation process was a meaningful but in some ways deeply problematic response to the injustices of apartheid. It revealed all the ways in which post-apartheid South Africa would continue to reflect apartheid's divides. There's a show on at the moment at the Apartheid Museum. Actually, Paul was telling me about it and I looked it up. It's called Can't Remember, Can't Forget. It's a solo exhibition by visual artist Sue Williamson, and her title accurately sums up the pathos of the last few decades of our country. The perpetrators of apartheid crimes approached the Truth and Reconciliation Commission because of the amnesty process, largely. But they could not remember their crimes. They were unprepared to implicate themselves in the very crimes of which they wanted to be absolved. During the TRC, pretty much only one person testified truthfully and in great detail about the apartheid crimes that he committed, Eugene de Kock. There were others who were a procession of gray men stuffed into gray suits, claiming that they could not remember. On the other hand, the victims and the survivors appeared before the commission in good faith. They could not forget. This is not new information, of course. We know that, to a large extent, the Rainbow Nation has been a hologram. The question that we must move forward with now is, how do we come up with a new framework, a new discourse that helps us to become a better country, a country that is capable of insisting on better leadership and having a functional democracy that is not held to ransom by elites who are able to trade on our inherited economic and racialized divisions?
South Africans, like Americans, have a sort of myth of exceptionalism. We tell ourselves that we are, you know, this wonderful, exceptional nation that was able to put the past behind it. So the idea that the past is behind us is a big story that we like to tell ourselves. And of course, if you look around Johannesburg, it's very obvious that the past is not behind this city or this country, because the kind of spatial way that apartheid manifested itself meant that black people lived very far, and then you had industrial centers where white people lived, and that differential in how those places look and who still lives there is so evident. Most black South Africans will spend 2/3 of their income monthly on transport, because you were dumped far out there, away from economic opportunities, and your role was to service the madams here in town. So you have to still, black people still live there, and the center of activity is still here. That architecture of apartheid, which is still with us, it's a highly developed country, but that makes it all the more difficult to undo.
Things are still difficult across South Africa. On the day Sisonke spoke in Johannesburg, tens of thousands of people massed in the streets, calling for President Jacob Zuma to step down. There were widespread allegations of corruption, cronyism, nepotism, and mishandling the economy. You may have wondered why Sisonke's reference to a birthday drew chuckles a bit earlier. Her talk and the protest marches coincided with President Zuma's birthday.
Let me suggest that the Zuma problem is not simply a problem of having an undemocratic and deeply compromised person at the helm. And the Zuma problem is not simply a problem of an ANC that is stubbornly stuck in the past and incapable of creating a functional education system or steering a working economy. Those are problems, but that, I think, is not the Zuma problem. The Zuma problem, I think, is evidenced in our collective responses to him. We are deeply unhappy about the man, but we don't trust one another enough to unite to force the party that he belongs to insist on his resignation. So Zuma and his henchmen have presided over Marikana. They announced terrible matric results year after year after year. They have failed to address the higher education crisis when thousands of students took to the streets. And now, finally, they're messing with white monopoly capital, our favorite word. And how have we responded? We have prevaricated about how to protest. Some of us have simply shaken our heads and say, "Hi, abelungu." Those ones are worse. So we have, in a way, been paralyzed by our history. Because there is very little holding us together aside from our shared history. We have had a very difficult time stepping forward together. We are still on one side the oppressor, and on the other the oppressed. And Zuma knows this and exploits it at every turn. And the next leader who replaces him will know this, and they too will exploit it at every turn. So we have to remove this as a source of division. And how we go about this is, of course, the million-dollar question. And I say dollar because the rand is falling. Some of us will pick it up. So whereas diversity in other countries is often used to describe a range of social, religious, and cultural differences, at the moment in South Africa, we are almost always talking about race when we talk about diversity, right? Even on those rare occasions when we do use the diversity language, we're really talking about race. Because we still find it really hard to talk about ourselves as a country outside of these notions of race. So even between and amongst people who used to be called colored and Indian and African, and who all agreed at the time that they were politically black, even then, our discussions about how we relate to one another live under this bigger shadow of our relationship to whiteness. We were all black in those days in the face of white racism, but in the post-apartheid society that we are now building, we have largely failed to explore our connections to one another. We rarely examine our own unwritten and underexplored histories, and when we do, it is often, too often, I think, based on conflict, on the hierarchy of oppression. And I'll come to that later, because it's not, we shouldn't ignore that. So I'm not suggesting we ignore that, tensions between different communities of color in this country. But I am proposing that we also have to begin to imagine a more interesting ways of relating to one another, ways that are about expanding the archive of stories that this country tells about itself. I'm not arguing that we stop talking about race or racism. To the contrary, we live in a violent and racialized economy. So that should correctly continue to be a significant focus of our time and energy. Still, we have to create a South Africa that isn't always turning towards whites and whiteness as a point of reference. I want to live in a South Africa in which diversity is a real and strong word, not this liberal, mealy-mealy-mouthed kind of thing that too often it is. I want to live in a South Africa where diversity and multiculturalism denote belonging. Too often, the immediate preoccupation is with ensuring that white South Africans still feel welcome, which is why I want to move away from this diversity and multiculturalism in the way it's currently framed. So we get seduced by the fragility of whiteness, distracted, preoccupied by the nervousness and the anxieties of white people. The anxiety about being rendered extinct. You see the white genocide websites, all the panic, this panic. So we privilege the feelings of white people, and whether we're soothing them or excoriating them, still, we are talking about them, often unthinkingly. So diversity comes, I think, to serve a liberal project. It becomes a way to reassure whites of their place in an otherwise black country. And of course, we understand the history of this, why this was important in the initial setting up of South Africa, et cetera, et cetera. I'm saying that 23, 24 years on, we need to be able to move away from that need to reassure, and we need to be able to explore our connections with one another without the focus on whiteness. So I want to break this up and turn my back on the fragility and the ownership of these terms. And I want to insist that we begin to assign everyone in South Africa to their proper place, to elevate diversity in ways that are deeply political. So, at the moment, I think we have no sense of proportion about the loudness of certain voices, right? So we have a wealthy and culturally dominant white minority, and they set out the terms for the discussion around these questions about art and culture and freedom of expression. They own the galleries, they curate the museum exhibitions, they take up column inches and op-eds, et cetera, right? They draw cartoons. So I want to turn my attention to understanding the richness of the histories that aren't in the mainstream, to understanding what happened and what is happening in relationships within and between Muslim communities, for example, to see the ways in which we are evolving new South African cultures that aren't overly conscious and respondent to whiteness. I want to tap into the political articulations, for example, in working class colored communities and neighborhoods, particularly in Cape Town, that have been so decimated by gentrification. There's a cultural story there that we simply aren't talking about. Yeah? I want to read about the struggles and triumphs that Nadia Davids explores with such sensitivity in her work. I want to immerse myself in Vashna Jagannath's writing about Indian food and its relationship to politics and history and culture. I want to talk about Mohau Modisakeng's show at the Venice Biennale. All of these young, creative South Africans who are sketching a new way of being that is invested in the past, of course, but keeps its eye firmly on the future.
Sisonke Nsimang is the first international speaker we're featuring in our series, Us and Them, Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference. I'm Paul Kennedy. You can see a video of the tour she took me on in Johannesburg on our website, cbc.ca/ideas. The series is produced by Ideas in partnership with the Laurier Institution. Sisonke's own past is complicated. I learned a little bit more about it when we were walking around anti-apartheid memorials on Constitution Hill.
And then that's a piece of graffiti there that says Viva MK. So MK was Mkhonto weSizwe, which was the military wing of the African National Congress, which is what my father joined when he was 21 years old. So he left in South Africa and went into exile to join Kontu Wesizwe. Went to Russia to learn how to use a gun so that they would come back and wage this liberation struggle. This is after Nelson Mandela declares that the revolution can no longer be only nonviolent, we have to take up arms. So that first lot of people who left the country, my dad was one of those.
Wow.
So he was part of MK.
Were you born at the time?
No, this was in the 1960s.
Wow.
Yeah, so we were born outside.
Wow.
Yeah.
Sisonke was born in Swaziland and raised in Zambia, Kenya, and Canada. Now she lives on planes, as she puts it, dividing her time between Australia and South Africa.
As in other settler colonial societies, in South Africa, multiculturalism is built into our bodies. But unlike other settler colonies like Australia and Canada and America, we are a majority black country. So we don't have to lie about our mixed blood and our complex ties to one another. We don't have to pretend about a non-existent cultural purity. We don't have to act as though we are grateful, as Helen Zille will have us believe, for the brutality and genocide that were wrought by colonialism. That's what it means to have a demographic majority in a country that for so long had a demographic minority. That we can be honest and serious about what multiculturalism has meant in our context. Indeed, if we had the leadership that we deserved, then as a country we could do what these societies refuse to do, which is to decolonize citizenship and belonging, to fling the category of South African open wider, to take the 3.1 million foreign-born people who are making a life in this country out of the present limbo in which they live, and to put their industriousness to work for the broader country, not for the little enclaves into which they have been forced. I long for the day when a Somali South African is on the cover of FinWeek, or whatever the name of these financial publications I don't read are, telling her story of setting up a chain of supermarkets to rival Makro or Pick and Pay, and thereby driving down food prices. Only a multicultural or diverse South Africa will produce that kind of story. Not as the South Africa that resists and insists that foreign-born people aren't really from here and aren't going to stay. While Europe and North America are abandoning multiculturalism in a wave of xenophobic and racist sentiment, we can make a different choice. We can walk towards multiculturalism, leaning into that aspect of ourselves that we haven't fully explored. We can take the concept more seriously. We can move beyond the superficial, the billboards, the simunye, the multi-toned beautiful people that we see in the tourism brochures. Whereas in 1994, we stepped into a political moment in which racial diversity came to signify a hopeful and optimistic future. Today, I think we have to accept that we didn't pay enough attention to the fuller idea of ourselves, to the cultural, the religious, the ethnic diversity that has always lived in South Africa, beyond the reach of white society's definitions and rules, the cultures that grew in shebeens, in the neighborhoods around mosques, in kitchens, in servants' quarters, in hideaways, in the caves, at the foothills of mountains, spaces where people in power did not want to go, spaces where culture was made. So as a consequence, South Africa is this counterintuitively a place where multiculturalism is both gloriously present in communities and yet is significantly under-theorized in terms of the public discourse around it. It's a country where we have many cultures and relatively little conflict around ethnicity and religion. Again, my home province, KZN, being a strange sort of exception there, but relatively little conflict around ethnicity and religion. And at the same time, it's a country in which outsiders aren't tolerated and where there are regular outbreaks of violence. It's a country in which women who wear trousers can be attacked, and in which lesbians are killed simply for being who they are. We live in a country in which a church can declare that homosexuals are unnatural, even as the principle of non-discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is enshrined in our beautifully African constitution. If we don't explore who we are in addition to racialized subjects, what hope do we have for addressing these issues, these contradictions? What hope do we have of making South Africa a country that, as the Constitution and the Freedom Charter say, belongs to all who live in it. Because all who live in it are not simply black and white. They are that in addition to a whole range of other things. A few years ago, I attempted to explore this idea in an essay on belonging. So I'm going to quote myself. And I wrote at the time, the idea that South Africans are so singular in our experience, that apartheid was such a unique experience that it makes us different from everyone else in the world, and especially from other Africans, is an important aspect of understanding the South African approach to immigration. As longtime researcher Nala Valji has noted, quote, the fostering of nationalism produces an equal and parallel phenomenon, that of an affiliation among citizens in contrast and opposition to what is outside that national identity. In other words, South Africans may not always like each other across so-called racial lines, but they have a kinship that is based on their connection to the apartheid project. Outsiders, those who didn't go through the torture and the detentions and the daily indignities of the apartheid regime, are juxtaposed against insiders. In other words, foreigners are foreign precisely because they cannot understand or recall the pain of apartheid. So, whether black or white, the trauma of living through apartheid is seen as such a defining experience that it becomes exclusionary. It has made a nation of us. And yet, the paradox, of course, is that though we are tied together as a nation by the horror of apartheid and living through it, even those of us who were not alive then are tied into the project by virtue of our race, we are also tied together like enemies trapped in a single house. At a national level, the most recent essay reconciliation barometer indicates that, quote, trust between the country's historically defined racial groups remains low. 67% of respondents note that they have little to no trust of their fellow citizens of other racial groups. 67% is a lot of people, two-thirds. In addition, 62% of respondents feel that race relations since 1994 have either stayed the same or deteriorated. So again, this is not about what's objective. It's about the fact that people feel that race relations have deteriorated. Let's note, because when you say 1994, you can get tricked into thinking it's just a date. Since apartheid. Race relations have deteriorated since the official end of apartheid. That's the feeling that people have. Despite this, South Africans generally believe that the country has made progress on the road to national reconciliation since the end of apartheid. So 60% of people believe that. And they are convinced that the country has to continue to pursue it as a national objective. So 70% of South Africans think we ought to continue on a path to reconciliation. So what are we to make of this? So much dissatisfaction and yet still so much hope and insistence on following the path of reconciliation. So many ties that bind and yet such rancorous division. In many ways, the paradox of South Africanness has been made magnificently clear in the racialized responses we have seen to the leadership of President Jacob Zuma. Polls show that the president is deeply unpopular amongst all race and age groups and across gender and ethnicity. If there's one thing about which most South Africans can agree, it's that Jacob Zuma is not such a great president. An Afrobarometer poll from 2016 noted that his approval ratings have plummeted to 34%, a sharp decline from the 62% he enjoyed in 2011, and the lowest trust a South African president has had since they've started recording these, which was in 2000. So perhaps it's important to step back a little. While people have argued that President Zuma is divisive, my sense is that while he may be polarizing within the ANC, he's not polarizing for South Africans. It seems that there is widespread agreement and widespread dissatisfaction with him. If anything, South Africans are unified in their disdain for him. Yet, as white South Africans opted to protest against Zuma, it was hard to ignore the fact that any project aimed at challenging Zuma's rule will need to reckon with the fact that South Africans themselves are divided, even when we agree on something as important as the incompetence of our president. Coalition building for a real democracy is long-term work. Because Zuma didn't divide us, history did. And as long as these divisions continue to deepen, so long as the trust deficit is not narrowing but deepening, we will never defeat tyrants. Because for many black people, crude as it may sound, a black tyrant will still be more of a brother or sister than a white one. Just as for many whites, a black tyrant will always be far worse, far more corrupt than a white one. And so as we look towards the future, towards creating a nation, rather than just a country, I think we need to consider how are we going to build trust and solidarity. Even in the absence of jobs and economic equality, we need a new language to move us forward, because the language of the rainbow, I think we are realizing, is past its sell-by date, right? So we've long recognized that. But that doesn't mean the project doesn't need to happen. It means it needs to be conceptualized differently in a way that people can relate to and in a way that is real and not overly sentimentalized. This stuff about how we all love each other, we don't see color, that doesn't work for people because it's not true. So given the reality of racism, the ways in which it's institutionalized, the ways in which it continues to be very violent against people. This morning we had a commuters where there's a strike. People are waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning, they get there, there's no bus, they're having to buy a taxi when you've got a bus card, and that those rants make a difference, right? So these issues are very, very real. So I'm not advocating a rainbowism, I'm advocating that we leave the rainbowism aside, but that the project of solidarity and trust must continue. So how do we reconceptualize it? We also need to think about it in ways that recognize not just black and white, but the 3.7 million immigrants, those people who are already here, foreign born. And so perhaps what we need to do is think about a language that is creedal. It's a great new word I learned, C-R-E-D-A-L, creedal. Did you guys know that word? Based on a credo, a mantra, a motto. So to build South Africanness on the basis of accepting the credo of South Africa, on the basis of accepting values, rather than simply being South African because we happen to have been situated in a particular geography and born here. History alone cannot be the basis of South Africanness.
The world is looking at Africa as, you're next. This is where it's going to happen.
Mm.
That's tremendously exciting to come here for, as an outsider.
No, yeah.
Yes, this is the future. The Chinese, the Indian, whatever empire is rising now.
Yeah.
But Africa is the real future.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, I feel like the Africa's moment happens at precisely the same time that we have a climate crisis. You know, again, if you look at refugees, if you look at global migration, and what are the push factors, why are so many young Africans leaving this continent? What's driving conflicts on this continent? Water scarcity is a huge issue that's been compounded by climate change. So on the one hand, yes, we have an economically active, we have this demographic boom, and there are so many more possibilities than they've ever been, but it's such a complex time to be alive, isn't it? You know, The two lungs of the world are the Congo River Basin and the Amazon River Basin. So we sit on this massive resource if we're going to deal with this carbon emissions and all of this stuff that's happening to the globe. So the importance of preserving and protecting the Congo River Basin and the waterways and the systems of this continent is, we cannot overestimate that. And at the same time, that very region, the Congo, is a place where titanium, coltan, like all of these cell phones that everyone needs in this world are being dug into, right? So this paradox of how much Africa is needed for the new kind of tech boom, as well as for precisely being underdeveloped. I mean, what a horrible and fascinating kind of thing to be reckoning with, all in the same place. It's a very complicated time for Africans to be trying to make their way. As Madiba always said, it's a long walk to freedom. So
let's keep walking.
Yeah, keep walking.
So let me tell a little story about my son, who is 6 years old, because it is for him that I named this title of this talk, Eyes at the Back of Our Heads, Moving Forward While We Look Back. Some of you know that I spend a lot of time in Australia. 2 years ago, we moved there. So my son is growing up as this little blackish boy amongst white people. And he has many of the protections of middle-class privilege, but he's still this little black child. And so my protective instinct as a mother is often to be extremely vigilant. You know how we are. So a few weeks ago, after school, he was riding his scooter, and we scoot home from school. Because you can walk in Australia. So, So he's just ahead of me, and he's on the scooter, and then I'm walking with another a friend of mine, another mother, an African mom. She's from Zambia. So the two of us are walking. He's just ahead, and he's busy chatting to a friend of his. But he's not that far ahead of us, and for some reason, this older woman comes in between us. So she's like awkwardly positioned in between us, and he's scooting and he's zigzagging, and I'm like feeling uncomfortable about this situation. I'm trying to get him to move out of the way. And so, but she's not saying anything. She's not saying, excuse me, she's not saying anything. She's just like awkwardly there and looking like she's getting a bit irritated. So then I say to him very sharply, I say, Sazi, please get out of the way. Careful what you're doing, because she's now started to move around him and they almost clip each other. So I get angry at the child and say, careful what you're doing. You need to be aware of that there are people around you. You're not the only person on the street. And she moves past and she doesn't say anything. And he stops his scooter and he turns and he looks at me and he says, well, she didn't say anything. I didn't know she was there. And you know what, mommy? I don't have eyes in the back of my head. So my friend laughed and she agreed with him, and it sort of softened the moment, because I had been too harsh on him. And my harshness came from the policing the black child. I wanted him to behave, to be in order. So he was right. He was right to reprimand me, you know. So my friend laughs and we agreed. But then afterwards we were talking about it, and she marveled at how he was claiming my own words, words he's heard his mother say so many times, and using them in his own way to suit his own purposes, as our children are wont to do. I tell this story because it operates on a number of levels. One, it tells us that one generation does not receive the wisdom in a straight line. It interprets and revises, and it critically assesses the value of said wisdom. He was saying to me what I've said to him, but he was inverting it. He was telling me that, yes, he listens to me, but he has a mind of his own. Where I typically say, I have eyes in the back of my head, he said, no, he doesn't, and he doesn't need to. He is free in a way that I never was, and in a way that my parents never could be, because he has a certain courage, an ability to not have to deal with the anxieties of race yet. But the lesson and the reason I would tell this story is not because I want him to grow up unburdened by who he is and unaware of what it means for him to be a black child in this world. My hope is that as he matures, he begins to understand that if he wants to be part of a sustainable and a peaceful and a just world, a contributing member of society, he will need to feel burdened by his freedoms. We who sit here in this room have largely landed on our feet in the new South Africa. Until recently, we often invoked the memories of those who died for freedom during the liberation struggle. We have said that we owe them a debt, and that our own actions must be exemplary because of them, because of the Mandelas and the Sisulus and the Kathradas. And of course that is true. But I want to turn this on its head a bit and suggest that we owe it to our future to be burdened by our own freedom as they were burdened by their lack of freedom. I want my son to know that the price he will have to pay for freedom, for riding on his scooter with the wind at his back and the sun on his face, is to understand that his is not the only voice. I want him to be aware of those around him. That in fact, yes, I was policing him, but I was also wanting him to understand that he can't occupy all the space and zigzag around as though he owns that pavement. That maybe there is a reason why the older woman was quiet, why she wasn't talking, and that my assumptions about it being because she's just a fuddy-duddy old white woman may be wrong. I want him to grow a pair of eyes in the back of his head, even as he keeps his face firmly set in the direction of the future. Post-apartheid South Africa was supposed to provide a safe haven for people seeking justice. It was supposed to be a new nation built on the lessons of the past. Looking backwards, it pledged that racism would never be tolerated, but looking forward, it should have also expanded the definition of belonging. Think for a moment about what it would mean if this country really were home to all who lived in it. It would mean culture and art and music. It might mean the beginnings of a new language, a Creole, a patois of Igbo and Sipedi and Lingala and Isizulu. It would mean perhaps remembering the Khoikhoi and the San who were here long before us. Today, South Africa is in the grips of a strangely depressing and weirdly exciting moment. Perhaps I was wrong earlier when I talked about the Zuma problem. Perhaps President Zuma is no longer a problem. Perhaps he is a gift. Maybe he has been sent to provide us an opportunity to remember what we promised ourselves we would be. When he opportunistically calls protests against him racist, he reminds us that we deserve better than this man who plays with the daily struggles of our mothers and fathers, who really do deal with racism on a daily basis. When he talks about radical economic transformation, does he take us for fools who cannot see his friends the Guptas as they radically hijack our economy? He reminds us that South Africans are black and white and queer and Indian and colored and white, and now we are also Kenyan and Nigerian and Congolese and Zimbabwean and Somali South Africans. And all of us stand on this soil, burning with the burden of freedom. And what a magnificent burden it is. We stand with diversity etched in our bones and written in our blood. We stand in a refusal to be trapped by the narratives of the past and the fragilities of the present. We talk and we call in to radio shows. We march and we disrupt. We laugh and we cackle. Because we know that we cannot rely on our leaders at this present moment. And that's okay. Because we are beginning to understand how we can come unstuck from this paralysis without coming undone. The key is to widen our understanding of who we are so that it is both mindful of race and so much bigger than race. Like our mothers, we have learned that in this new world we are making, we must have eyes in the backs of our heads. We are learning to scan the wreckage of history and mine it for gold, for the connections between us, even as we walk with our eyes firmly fixed on the horizon, as we move ever forward towards a South Africa in which we all belong. I thank you.
You were listening to Ideas and Sisonke Umsimang in this, the first of a five-part series called Us and Them, Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference, produced in partnership with the Laurier Institution. The episode was produced by Lisa Godfrey and Greg Kelly. We'd like to extend a huge thanks, one as deep as it is heartfelt, to Siwa Majubela for his last-minute magic in helping make the event at Constitution Hill a reality. Thanks as well to Sandra McArdle, Canada's High Commissioner to South Africa, and to her staff for their help and participation. And of course, thanks to Sisonke for her public lecture and for her private shopping advice.
Here's the ridiculous thing. I'm trying to buy a Mandela shirt for tomorrow.
So you haven't found a shirt?
Well, that's what I mean. And I, yeah.
You know what? Don't wear a Madiba shirt. Go to Rosebank, get an African print shirt. Okay. That'll be lovely. And like 10 times cheaper. Yeah. And look nice, you know.
Yeah.
So
and the symbolism is probably going to be lost on anyone. Anyway, so.
Audio and video production, James Cooper. Additional technical production, Dave Field. Liz Nagy is the associate producer of Ideas. The executive producer is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.